It is so good to be with you all this morning. Not only did I attend Calvary in 2009, but when I tell the story of how I ended up as a pastor, this church is instrumental in it. It was here where I saw myself for the first time as called and as a proclaimer. So it's a real gift to be back. It's also lovely to be with my brother and his partner, Grace, Calvary newbies. Thanks for loving them well as they've come in to the district. And people at my church would be very upset if I did not say that Emmaus Way loves camping with Calvary at Wild Goose, and they hope to see you there, I guess in June, and maybe I'll make it there too. Let us pray. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, Emmanuel, who are with us even now. Amen. Back in Durham, a dear friend and clergy colleague of mine's ministry finds him day and night in the sex worker district of our city. And just this week, after three tragedies occurred, day after day, he just simply remarked, "One of the most heart-wrenching things about this work is that the people, the women that call this block home, are nameless and are unwanted in our city. Dismissed because we too easily deem them worthless. Rahab might be the only sex worker that is not nameless for you." This named sex worker appears to be one of the most powerless kinds of non-Hebrew people that an ancient Israelite storyteller could have constructed. A despised Canaanite, marked for extermination under Israel's holy war regulations, she represents the sexual cultural tension and danger of an outsider mingling with the pure Israelite. Rahab lives in tumultuous space of grave risk for sexual violence and death. And by the time Rahab's name is uttered in this story, I imagine Rahab is simply understood by many as worthless. Rahab knows longing, isolation, oppression in the marrow of her bones. It's not exactly like sex workers then or now are necessarily treated with human decency and basic human rights that they deserve. Rahab had been waiting for far too long to be taken seriously, to be seen, to be understood. No one expects Rahab, this sex worker, to be cunning and powerful and articulate, naming her desire for a more equitable world and life. But when those two spies show up in the dark looking for safety, this named sex worker does something very few expected. She flips the script. She holds the power. She takes control and she rises up. She is smart, proactive, and unafraid to break the norm. Rahab, in her own defiant way, through covering these spies with leaves on her roof, claims her name, claims her identity, claims her spot, and puts those Hebrew men in their place, reminding them of her innate power as she willingly dangerously protects them, telling them, I imagine, in the words of Maya Angelou, you may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Because I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awful hard, because I laugh like I got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still like air I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it cause a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of huts of history's shame, I rise up from a past that's rooted in pain. I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling. I bear in the tide. I rise. I rise. I rise. Rahab rises. But this unexpected rising did not come without a cost, as she made way for the Hebrews to enter the Promised Land. Later on in the story, we're told Rahab chooses not to warn her Jericho neighbors about the looming genocidal onslaught. She sings of the God of Yahweh helping God's people, but some argue in doing so betrayed her own, slipping out of the city with her own family, but no one else. Rahab's family, as the story is told, becomes the sole Canaanite survivors of something utterly monstrous in our scriptures. After the conquest, they are forever set outside the camp, never welcomed or embraced by Israel, the very people Rahab helped, but merely tolerated in a marginal position. The story and life of Rahab is not without complication. But the fact that Rahab is not only a key player in this story, in the Hebrews making it to the Promised Land, but in also in how the very story of Jesus is told, forces us, regardless of complication and complexity, to confront our own assumptions when it comes to persons for whom sex is their work and their role in our society and in our lives. The story of Rahab's named existence as one with power and purpose flipped the script then and flips the script now on who is woven into the beloved, broader, complex narrative of God. And mind you, Rahab is woven into this narrative not because she spoke of the God of Yahweh, but simply because she existed. Raised her voice and said, to heck with it, you people. You're going to finally know my name, and I'm going to rise up. And it is from this very story of a sex worker that we're given a named mother of the movement. Not Sarah, not Deborah, not even Esther, but Rahab. She is one of the five canonized for all to remember as a prominent ancestor of God incarnate. And I can't help, except when reading Rahab and this story, to think what Rahabs are still in our midst today. Mothers of the movement in the here and now, whom we've tried to keep nameless and are trying still to dismiss and not recognize their rising. There are no official figures on how many sex workers are in the world. Statistics range between 13.8 million and 30 million. And despite social seclusion, one historian notes that every worker and every woman, regardless if you have any interaction with the sex work industry, have sex workers to thank. For they have been heavily involved in more equitable wages and more equitable rights for all people. They have been on the edge pushing progress even when we refuse to notice them. But outside of the sex worker industry, too often in history, this work and these people go nameless. For example, even though the Stonewall Uprising was sparked by Sylvia Rivera, a trans sex worker, an uprising which served as a catalyst for the gay rights movement in the United States and around the world, almost every sex worker engaged in that riot and that uprising is removed from the history. Juno, a sex worker and recently interviewed, observed, "We are firmly embedded within other movements, weaving our advocacy through resistance to the prison industrial complex, in opposition to police violence and borders, the struggle against austerity, or the fight for drug decriminalization. As you can tell, we rise up for a lot of causes, not just our own, and we'll keep doing it, even if people refuse to see our rising and join along." Do we, in this sanctuary, even notice their rising? Know them to call out their name, to see them as siblings woven into this beloved, broader, complex narrative of God? And if we don't, how and where do we even begin? Beginnings, right, are kind of funny things. And the church is a bit odd because our beginning of a new year doesn't begin on January 1st, but it began last week, with the start of Advent. And those of us gathered here find ourselves in the midst of Advent, a new beginning offering itself as an invitation into a season of waiting, and waiting some more. But it's a peculiar type of waiting, isn't it? It's a waiting we're invited into in the darkness. Of this season, historian and writer Kate Bowler reflects, "Darkness seems to always carry a bad reputation. Whether literally or metaphorically, it represents the unknown, the scary, the avoid at all costs. But perhaps there are things that we can't learn under blazing artificial city light that we can only learn in the dark. Waiting in the dark pushes us to learn some things we'd rather avoid. It pushed those Hebrew spies. It's an opportunity to see differently. It's an invitation to more intimately understand a God who has come and will come again in unexpected ways. It's uncomfortable, and perhaps some of us try to avoid the dark. But this waiting in the darkness is key to our living. For this waiting in the dark pushes us not only to know and learn differently and to see differently, but it also pushes us to hear differently too. My brother Will and I, where Sally went to college, are from a really tiny town in East Tennessee. We grew up smack dab in between Knoxville and Dollywood, two places you've maybe heard of, kind of near Dolly Parton, though we've never met. I wish I would have met her, but I haven't. And it's small in the way that, like, we have more than one stoplight, right? But I don't think we've hit 10, okay? So I think there's probably 10 stoplights just right on this block. It's tiny. And every time I've gone home since moving away over a decade ago, I'm struck by how dark it gets there. How, when I am out at my parents' home, my home, sitting on their deck, that I can see the Milky Way when they're in the Big Dipper, and I start to feel within myself this uncomfortable anxiousness that it's too dark. And as I'm sitting and being anxious, I start to hear these owls hooing, or if it's springtime, I'll hear a lot of bugs just chirping. I might hear deer jumping through the leaves in their backyard. There's this space where it's like I not only hear creation anew, but I'm able to hear the spirit of our living God anew too. It's only in the vast darkness where there is space for me to sit and be open to things that I might even be a little scared of. Sitting and waiting in the dark this Advent opens the space for us to, yes, maybe be a little uncomfortable and a little anxious. But it opens the space for us to hear the spirit of our living God anew. And as we sit in the dark and hear God anew, we more clearly hear the voices, the beloved named people that God has come beside and is continuing to come beside, rising alongside of them. It's in the dark we're able to hear the voices of Rahab and Juno and Sylvia and Vivian and all the people under the bustling city lights that we too easily deem unworthy, not worth our time. There's no way in heck that we could possibly be woven into the broader, beloved, complex narrative of God with them. For it is in the dark that we hear and see and know a God who has come and is coming still in ways unimaginable. For it is in the dark we see and hear a God flipping the script, rising up, and inviting us to do so too. How or where might we begin to hear and know those names of the Rahabs in our midst, of the countless sex workers, of those we deem unworthy simply by our inattention or afterthought? We begin right where we are, in the darkness of Advent. And into this very darkness of Advent, though we can't hear it that loudly yet, is a baby's cry breaking out in a manger, rising and rising still. And they shall call him Emmanuel. God is with us. And as he cries, his voice joins with his ancestral mother of the movement, Rahab. And together they proclaim, "Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still like air I rise. I rise, I rise, I rise." Thanks be to God.